I was thinking about this song in lots of different ways because I, as a pastor, find myself in regular situations where wellness of soul is hard to come by. I'm not just talking about people like Ted and Brenda who shared their story with us this morning, but if we all took the time to be just truly transparent, we would talk about monsters. And we would talk about giants in our lives. We would talk about our constant and continuing battle with alcohol. We would talk about the loneliness and depression that comes with not being known really by anybody. We would talk about the relationship mess that doesn't seem to be getting better at all in any way. And then we would be all on the same page where we recognize, you know something, this thing we're about, this song that we have just sung, this truth that we're going to share in these moments is truly astounding, if not miraculous, that God offers us the stuff of wellness for people like us. I love this song that we just sang. It is, in fact, one I hear frequently because I officiate at many memorials, and it's a favorite of families. It's a favorite of some that make a point of saying, please sing this song at my passing, especially the last verse that says, I will come again, the clouds will part. And I know this morning I'm talking to people who've lost. A dear mother stopped me at the door first service and said it was 8 years ago that her son died. And there is more hope in her heart today than imaginable because of the truth that we're going to talk about. Do tears come? They came the whole time. They came the whole service. But does that truth stabilize someone in hurricane winds? Yeah, it does. All right, I want to tell you about something fun. I live on a street that's 14 houses. It's a cul-de-sac, a quiet cul-de-sac, and it's a really neat thing has happened in our neighborhood in the last couple of years. Families have moved back in. It's not like we chased them off. It's just our neighborhood grew up, you know, and matured, we like to say. But with that came kids that grew up too. And the shouts and the screams and the cries and the crazy that comes with little children sort of subsided. Not by design, but just, or not by choice, but just it's how it happens. Kids grow up. So these new neighbors moved into our neighborhood, and there is a brand new feeling of life, thanks to little people on Luke Lane where we live. It's really a cool thing. I mean, seriously, there's sidewalk chalk again. I mean, what's not to love about that? I have one neighbor that doesn't like it. So, you know, she had a problem when my kids were drawing with sidewalk chalk, and she still does, and it makes you want to draw on her house. But anyway, I just love it. There's sidewalk chalk everywhere. You know what? There's basketball games in a little lowered basketball hoop in our driveway with all the neighborhood kids who want to come across and play basketball. And there's those little signs. You probably saw them at Costco. And Debbie and I have thought, you know, if those were available when our kids were little, we would have had one. It's this little bright neon yellow guy with a flag, and he sits on the street, and he says, "Slow children at play." Is that a cool thing or what? I mean, it's all there. We have it all. We even have ridiculously overpriced lemonade stands. My kids used to get a nickel or a dime. They want a buck now for that. And you know what? I give them two, all right, because I love them being there. Here's something I do on a daily basis, just so you know. I come home. I've been to hospitals. I've visited with people that are hurting and struggling. And I come around the corner in my very manly truck, okay? And it gets attention, okay? You come around a corner, and it's a diesel, and it's loud enough to command attention. Well, it doesn't take a lot on our street. You start up slowly, and I've slowed way down. And I start up the street, and sure enough, almost daily, they come running out of their houses, and they want to jump in the truck. We've cleared all this with moms and dads, and I stop, and they get in the truck, and they can sit anywhere they want. Most of the time, there's sort of a fight over who gets in the cab, and then sometimes they all want to be in the back box. And we just putz up. We begin our journey in my big man truck, and it's like a whole 100 feet, right? And these kids are squealing like crazy. They're having a blast. Our dog's barking, and I make the corner slowly, looking in the mirror and watching that no one's falling out, and they come back around, and I park in front of our house, and I rev it up a little bit and then shut it off. And kids are just like, yeah, this is so cool. And I go, popsicles for everyone. And you know what? We have a freezer in the garage, and they know exactly where to go. Is that great? And you know why I like that? I like it because, in a weird kind of way, call me corny, it causes the stuff of seriousness to stay away. Just a little further, it pushes it back a little bit. There's an author, M. Scott Peck, who wrote a book that was an amazing best-selling book, and he wrote it before he knew Jesus. He now knows Jesus. And in it, there are three words that begin the book, and those children on our street are helping me push back those words every time what just happened happens. You know what the words are? Life is difficult. Life is hard. Life is difficult. Unfortunately, you and I don't have to be alive for very long before you lose touch with sidewalk chalk. Before it bugs you. Before you tell kids, hey, could you keep it down out there? Before they play a wiffle ball and the ball goes in your yard and it bugs you. Before your dog goes potty in someone else's yard. Which is really cool when it happens to the right home. But anyway, you get the idea. Unfortunately, you don't have to be alive very long before pain replaces that stuff, replaces laughter as the dominant language of our lives. Before too long, serious shows up and laughter leaves. And you go from enjoying life to enduring it. Solomon was right when he said this. If you haven't read these words from Ecclesiastes, his memoirs, chapter 12 begins this way. Remember your creator in the days of your youth, when you played with sidewalk chalk. Before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say to yourself, I find no pleasure in them. Have those days come for you? Do those words define your life today? I admit to you, they could easily define my life. And I'm doing something about it. Because I know you, and you know enough about me to know that we today live with things like loneliness and depression. We live with things that are hard to live with, discouragement. I'm looking in the faces of people that have faced their share of defeat this week. Not to mention grief. And some of you, to be very honest in this moment, have suffered for so long you're considering throwing in the spiritual towel. Never mind the fact that the Bible promises problems. The very last words Paul said to Timothy before Paul finally got to go home were problem words. Realize this. If you want to walk with Jesus, you will be persecuted. Don't forget that. Problems. Troubles. And for the record, it doesn't really make it a lot easier or lighten the load to talk about it. Rick Warren was right when he said, explanations don't take away the pain. Have you felt that? Somebody came alongside you and tried to give you a pep talk you off the ledge. help you over the hump. And when they left, you went, phew. First of all, that didn't help. And secondly, I'm glad you're gone. So explanations don't take away pain. What does? More correctly, who does? This morning, we're going to talk about that. The feature song today and this last Sunday in this, I think, a wonderful series we've had together called Behind the Music, we've tried to examine truth of songs and find out where the author or the composer found their inspiration. Essentially, what's the backstory of these various songs? And the song that we just sang, It Is Well With My Soul, was written by a very real guy. In fact, when I tell you about him, you're going to say, wow, he was living the dream. We would say of this particular man, he was living the sweet life. His name's Horatio Spafford. And in the mid-1800s, a married man of with four children, daughters, lived in Chicago. He had a very successful law practice. He had life by the tail. And on top of all that, he loved Jesus Christ. He had a very personal relationship with Jesus. And it was so real to him, he spent lots of time and effort trying to tell other people about Jesus and how to have a relationship with Jesus. We would call a guy like that today an evangelist. In fact, so passionate was he about his relationship with Jesus and his desire to tell others that he became lifelong friends and supporters of a man in that day named D.L. Moody. He was the mid-1800s version of Billy Graham, an evangelist who gave his life to telling people how to have a relationship with Jesus. And then trouble struck. Here's how it was remembered. A series of calamities, beginning with the Great Chicago Fire in 1871, which wiped out the family's extensive real estate investments. You say, well, there's insurance. No, there wasn't. He was gone. It was gone. It'd be like everything you own was stolen, and it's Job-like in your loss. When Mr. Moody and his music associate Ira Sankey left for Great Britain on an evangelistic campaign to tell people how to have a relationship with Jesus, Spafford decided the timing was right to lift the spirits of his family by taking them on a vacation to Europe. And while in Europe, his plan was to connect with Moody and Sankey and be a part of these campaigns to talk about Jesus. In November of 1873, Spafford was detained by urgent business back in Chicago. So he decided to send his wife and four daughters as scheduled ahead, planning to join them as soon as he could. Halfway across the Atlantic, the ship was struck by an English vessel and sank in 12 minutes. All four of Spafford's daughters, Tanetta, Maggie, Annie, and Bessie, were among the 226 people who perished. Mrs. Spafford was among the few who the story's detailed, but was miraculously saved. Horatio Spafford stood hour after hour on the deck of a ship that was carrying him to his sorrowing wife in Wales. And when the ship passed the approximate place where his precious four daughters drowned, Spafford received sustaining comfort from God that enabled him to write, "When sorrows like sea billows roll, it is well, with my soul." I want to ask a show of hands. How many of you hearing that story today can say, you know, if that happened to me, I would find the strength, I would be able to put words like that to song? I didn't expect a hand to go up. Mine's certainly not up. I will go so far as to say if Spafford were here today and we asked him the same question, gave him this awful scenario, what if you lost all your kids in a tragedy? Would you be able to write words like that? I think he would emphatically say, not a chance. No way. It will never be well with my soul again. So that raises a question. Where did he get that strength? To say, when sorrows like sea billows roll, it is well. It is well with my soul. Where did he get that kind of strength? the same place and the same person that you and I get that kind of strength, God. My Bible's open to Psalm 46. I'd like you to, in haste, make your way there, if you would, this morning. Page 393, if you're reaching for the Bible that's in a chair rack near you. Here's something while you're on your way there that I want you to know. We're unclear about the historical setting of Psalm 46, which I think is a good thing. Because that means, since we aren't quite sure, we could speculate maybe it was at a time of war. We know it was a time of trouble. We're just not specific as to where or when that struggle occurred. I think it's a good thing because it keeps us from doing what I call contextual limitation. Meaning, we tend to go, well, this worked in that situation, but my story is different. I'm a teenager and life stinks. You're telling me this will work for me? It works when an approaching army or whatever it was. Well, we don't know what it was. And that avoids that mistake. Because here's the deal, and you know this. Trouble is trouble, isn't it? I'm not sure any of us wants to get in an arm wrestling match over your trouble's more than mine or mine's more than yours. Trouble is trouble. So let's read this psalm the way I think God wants us to read it, with a current view of your trouble and my trouble. Let's keep that in mind and where to turn in trouble. Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength and ever-present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her. She will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Nations are in an uproar. Kingdoms fall. He lifts his voice and the earth melts. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come and see the works of the Lord, the desolations he has brought on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. We're being told here, and please take time to write this down. God is a constant companion for his people. Do you know that to be true in your life? In fact, we're told right at the beginning, God is a constant companion for his people. By the way, you're not automatically one of his people. You need to understand that. If you're saying, well, I don't feel that. I've never experienced that. You need to experience rebirth. You're not born into his family. You enter into his family through an adoption relationship where he chooses you to become one of his. If you've not done that, you need to bow the knee to Jesus. You need to say, you know, Jesus, not just physically bow the knee, but I want to surrender to you. I want to surrender to your absolute authority over me and every part of me. That's how you become what the Bible calls in John 3, born again and a child of God. That's how you enter into a relationship with Jesus, which D.L. Moody and Horatio Spafford were so excited about. And frankly, I am too. Okay, so God is a constant companion to his people. Now look how this psalm begins. There are three times we're told that God is with us. Beginning in verse 1, God is our refuge and strength. I love these two words together, this combination word, ever-present help. In a sweeping statement, he's saying his help is ever-present. So what's that mean? Well, he's not saying there's a forecasted promise of help someday. He's saying my help is real and present now. You experience that? He says it again in verse 7. The Lord Almighty is with us. Verse 11, the Lord Almighty, again, is with us. God is a constant companion to his people. And notice, God's help, notice when it arrives. Notice verse 1, in trouble. That's why he says an ever-present help. You see the preposition? In trouble. Here's what you need to know if you love the song. I think it was Simon and Garfunkel years ago when I was a kid. Bridge Over Trouble. Like a bridge over troubled waters. Remember that song? Maybe you don't. You can forget it if you applied it to God, because it's not true. Did you hear me? God is not your bridge over troubled waters. Jesus is your help in troubled waters. People, there's a difference there. Your faith will falter if you are looking to God as this God with genie powers or pixie dust that's going to somehow cause you to sail over the creepy, rotten things that happen to everybody else. Because he's your bridge over troubled waters. Not true. So don't sing that song and think of Jesus. It's a cool song, maybe. Maybe not. It's old. But anyway, you get my idea? He's our present help in trouble. He is with his people, what he's saying here, in the midst of their problems. People, that's good stuff. That's good to know. He's not saying, I'm going to offer you peace. I'm going to offer you help when you finally make it home. No, my help is yours as you are on this journey toward home. That's how it works. When problems are present, when you're in a jam, when you're in a real tight spot, a pinch, that's when this promise is true. Ever-present help in trouble. And by the way, verses 2 and 3 immediately add a kind of a refreshing realism. He's not talking about just sort of imaginary things here. He talks in terrifying terms. Look at the kind of graphic language. Therefore, we will not fear. And he lists some of the things that would make any of us fear, wouldn't it? I mean, the earth give way. Do you see that? Or mountains fall into the sea. Or he picks up again, when waters roar and foam and mountains quake, San Francisco style, maybe a reference to an earthquake. I mean, that's big stuff. I find two different sort of pictures here. A short list, if you and I made a short list of massive earth attributes, on our list would be mountains and oceans. Have you ever been to the mountains and stood there in absolute awe, like, oh my? Or gone to the beach and you're standing on the beach, same impact. You look at the ocean, you're like, wow, that is huge. Rivers are impressive, but not like 10,000, 14,000, 400-foot Rainier. Are you kidding? Whoa. And the image here is that the problems have that sort of size to them. The problems of our lives feel as big as a mountain or as vast as an ocean. That's the idea here. Debbie and I just went camping. We were up on the east side, kind of the northeast side of Mount Hood. Go to Hood River and head south up into the mountains there. And we were actually on a kind of a loop called the Fruit Loop. This time of year, the trees are full of fruit. It's a bountiful valley there with pears and berries and bees and things like that. So we went there. We just had this blast. But you know what happened? While we're rarely on that side of Mount Hood, we would look back, and almost everywhere we went, every corner we would turn, there was this vast, looking to the south, there was this vast mountain, Mount Hood. And turn to the north, and you know what you saw then? Mount something north. Adams. There you go. Adams. So you got Hood to the south, Adams to the north. Virtually everywhere you turned, there's these massive mountains that sort of almost created a shadow. You were aware of their size. And sort of intimidate. In fact, at one point, I remember thinking, hold on. I've heard somewhere that these are active volcanoes. And lest you dismiss that like just, you know, fanciful. Well, what happened to Mount St. Helens? is not too distant in our memory here in the Northwest. We remember an active volcano, and the magnitude of the disaster that ensued. The verses 2 and 3 are saying, you know, problems are as big as mountains. They're ubiquitous. They're everywhere you turn. And I'm not just talking evening news in Ukraine. I'm talking in your own life. But notice this, God's help is ever present. Which raises this question, a take-home point. How can that help be ours? How can we have his help in these kinds of troubles? The kind that you're thinking about right now. Two secrets are shared. The first is in verse 8 and the second is in verse 10. Look at verse 8. Come and see the works of the Lord, the desolations he has brought on the earth. I would say it this way. Turn your focus from your troubles, which he's talked about, mountain size, ocean size. Turn from your troubles to the one who will be with you in your troubles. That's why he says, come and see. This is contrary, people, to human nature. Unless you're quite unique, we instinctively, when we face a problem, we instinctively fasten our work belt, our tool belt, and we do what? We go to work on the problem. We roll up our sleeves, if we had them, and we went for it. And we stay on that problem until it is, say it with me, solved. That's what we do. That's human nature. But we're told here to turn from those problems to our God who will help us through them. And please don't miss, this is not just some vague reference to God. Verses 7 and verse 11 tell us some unique attributes of God. He is the Lord Almighty. See that verse 7? He's with us. This God of Jacob is our fortress. What's he saying here? He's not a little God. The Lord Almighty is all-powerful, omnipotent God. That's that God. And then what's God of Jacob mean? Well, at the very least, one thing it means is the writer of this psalm is pointing back in time hundreds of years to one of the patriarchs, Jacob. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? You know what that tells me? This God who says, I'm going to be there and help in your troubles, I have a proven track record of doing that very thing. Ask Jacob. I'm this God who's almighty, and I am the God with a proven track record of helping my people when they face big troubles. So that's the first secret, verse 8. I told you there's a second one. First secret, turn your focus from your troubles to the one who will help you in your troubles. This next one's no easier to do. Verse 10, it's a favorite for the verses at least. Be still and know that I am God. Take time to be still before the Lord so he can restore wellness to your soul. People, this won't be easy. When you and I read the words be still, we're reading words that have a Hebrew root, which means to stop moving. Ready for this? Relax. Now, people, listen. Think of your troubles. Is that your instinct? To relax? The Hebrew word means literally to be silent. Most of us, especially when troubles have come, find it nearly impossible to do those things, don't we? That's my experience. That's my story. To relax? Are you kidding me? We want to run as fast as we can to a remedy, a fix. It's human nature. And it doesn't help when people go, hey, what are you doing about it? What are you going to do about it? You slacker? Get up, you lazy lard. Get going. You've been told that or some hint of that? After all, we're American. Relax. Be still also means do nothing. People, we want to try everything that we can to bring us relief. And be silent? No, we want to shout. It's human nature to shout. I heard a funny story I got to tell you about. This man goes rock climbing. He's way up high in the mountains. And he's climbing this steep face when suddenly he loses his grip and it's a free fall. It would have been certain death, but about 1,000 feet down, banging against the wall, he somehow there's this branch of a tree that he gets caught on, and it's an abrupt stop. But at least he was able to stop and actually hold on. He was conscious still, but pretty beat up. So he gathers his wits, looks at his surroundings, and begins to cry out and call out, "Hello, I need some help. Need some help, please, somebody help." Silence. So he continued, "Hey, somebody up there, is there anybody up there?" Finally, a voice. "Hello, there's somebody here. Is that Jack?" "Yeah, it's Jack, Jack. Yeah, who are you?" "I'm God," came the voice. "Oh, okay, God. Jack, are you okay? Well, I'm pretty beat up, I'm pretty hurt, but I'm alive and I need some help. And can you send me some help?" And God says, "Okay, Jack, I'm here to help you. Here's what I want you to do. Let go." And Jack says, "Let go? What do you mean? I'm on a cliff. I'll fall to my death." The words came again. "Let go, Jack, let go." A long silence. Jack, looking up, said, "Is there anybody else up there?" Don't we do that? God says, just let go of it. Let go. And God says, "I know it's hard for you to do. That's how my help works. Actually, if you could fix it, you wouldn't need me, would you?" Let me be very clear about what God is saying to us about surviving these troubles. When he says, be still, verse 10, he is prescribing a pathway to his peace and to his help when troubles come into our lives. So if I can frame your troubles as a question, "God, what do you want me to do?" I think God would say, "Nothing. Leave it up to me. But God, I'm scared to death. I want you to trust me. I want you to count on my help in your trouble. And wellness will once again return to your soul." I'd like you to bow your heads this morning. Your troubles, I know this to be true. Your troubles are very real. These are not imaginary. And maybe for you, boy, that moment came in this study this morning when you thought of mountains and oceans and thought, that is my story, Pastor. My troubles are like a constant shadow from a large mountain in my life. And the psalm began the way I want to end. God wants to be your refuge and my refuge and strength. He does. In spite of our troubles. But to be those things, we've got to turn to him. And we've got to be still long enough to hear him say, "Steve, I love you. Child, I love you. I'm here to help." So God, we come to you as people, grateful, hugely grateful that we are your children by faith in your Son. That doesn't make our lives problem-free. We need help for our souls to be well. Give us a heart that trusts you in troubles. When we find fear rising up, cause us to trust in you, the God of angel armies, the Lord Almighty. To cause us to rise above our fears and have wellness for our souls. In Jesus' name I pray. In a moment we're going to sing a final song. And Whom Shall I Fear is the title. It's a wonderful song. We were tempted to make this one for a whole morning focus as well, and we will sometime. But when we sing it, I want to remind you of the fact that we began this service realizing that worship is a choice. To sing Whom Shall I Fear is a choice that you and I can make right now in our troubles, in our problems. So you can choose, not just in this moment, what's a little easier than normal, but anytime. Ushers are going to gather up prayer requests, which represent some of those mountains that you're facing. Would you drop those in as the offering plate goes by? And as you give your offering to God this morning, give it also from your heart in singing this final song, Whom Shall I Fear? Let's stand together and sing.